call the Eastern Municipal Water District Board of Directors meeting to order, this being June 3rd, 2020, time being just a little after 9 a.m. Nick, would you lead us in the salute to our flag, please?
Please stand. Join me in the pledge.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Sheila, could we have a roll call so that we know everyone is here this morning and who's present here on the dais and who's on the phone?
Yes. Director Polly?
I am here on the dais.
Director Corona?
Here on the dais.
Director Record?
Calling in, here.
Director Slauson?
Here, calling in, present.
All right. Do we have counsel with us this morning?
Yes, we do, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you very much. All right, with that, this is a time reserved for public comments. Any subject within the jurisdiction of EMWD, speakers are required to limit their comments to 3 minutes. And having no speaker cards and seeing no one raise their hand, we'll go on to the executive reports. Paul, General Manager's report, please.
President Sullivan, members of the board, my written report's included in your package. Just want to highlight a few items. One of the things we've been working on recently that's fairly significant is Metropolitan's Integrated Resources Plan. MET is doing a 2020 update to the IRP. They update that document every 5 years or so. I think this IRP is particularly significant because of obviously the changes we're seeing in Metropolitan in terms of their demands, the need for ongoing programs to subsidize local resources programs, and a number of very significant issues. The process that MET's established includes a substantial interface with the member agencies at a number of different levels. It includes technical committees, as well as through the general managers. And then they also have a substantial outreach process to public stakeholders. And for example, on May 20th and May 22nd, they had two separate virtual meetings to seek input from the public. Those stakeholder meetings had over 500 participants, so they were fairly substantial. And so it's really, I think, a very comprehensive process. The way the process is going is they're starting out with an initial step to establish and define what are so-called drivers of change. In other words, what's driving changes in Metropolitan and the member agencies' world? These can be things like climate change. They can be things like reduced sales at Metropolitan, and also external factors that can affect Metropolitan's future and the future of the member agencies. Once those drivers of change have been established, they'll then work on assumptions, kind of what they're calling quantitative assumptions, and future demand scenarios. So this would be what would demands look like under, for example, certain conditions in the State Water Project on the Colorado River for local resources, and then determine, based on those scenarios, essentially run kind of an array of portfolios, water supply portfolios, and essentially look at the most flexible portfolios and strategies that can meet those future needs, recognizing they may need to be adapted over time. And those portfolios could be certain investments at the member agency level, certain investments by Metropolitan, for example, on their recycled water program, et cetera. So this process is really starting to get into gear right now. The schedule currently calls for the process to be completed around the end of the calendar year. I think it's going to go into early 2021. But we will be providing a very detailed overview of the Integrated Resources Plan process to both the Planning Committee on June 11th, and then we'll give the board an overview of the process on June 17th. We are also, throughout the process, engaging particularly Rancho and Lake Hemet, member agencies of ours, to make sure they get any input to us on this. We're making them aware of the workshops, and we'll continue to interface with them. Under past and ongoing activities, as you've probably noticed, we are starting to transition employees who are on the work from home status, the 280 employees back into the office, into regularly scheduled hours and reporting locations. We are making that transition gradually. So we are now bringing those employees back a couple of days a week. In that regard, we're looking at providing and have provided guidelines and for the departments and developed individual transition plans for those departments that look at things like staggered reporting days, alternating use of work areas, the in-office social distancing practices, and so forth. So we're going to continue to monitor this on every two-week basis. But the goal is to bring back staff over time and until we are fully restaffed in the office. That being said, I think one of the things we learned from this is there is capability for employees to work very effectively remotely. And so we will be developing a policy that we look to implement in the future that would allow more flexibility as far as remote reporting. I also want to point out there's been, as you know, if you've looked at the news, these protests. I want to say that what we've done is interfaced with law enforcement in the region and the county and have been able to get information on where those protests have been and located, even time of day. And earlier in the week, we communicated with our field staff and with our employees when and where those were going to be. Encourage employees when they're commuting to avoid those locations, but also our field staff, basically encouraging them to completely stay out of those areas when those events are ongoing. Of course, a lot of this has been pointed, the violence and so forth has been against police, but there's also been around the country incidents of public safety, fire department, or even public agencies, anything with a logo on it, of protesters and kind of these people who are causing trouble, bothering those folks. So we've just had our staff be clear, and I want to let you know we did work with the staff and get all employee notices out earlier in the week on that. On customer service, relative to what we've seen with the impact of the virus in the service area, just a quick report on that, and of course we're going to do regular, more detailed reports, but our account aging greater than 60 days, which we talked to you about at our last board meeting, decreased slightly last week to about 8.9%. As you recall, we were at almost 11% at the end of April. However, we're still very substantially higher than April in 2019, where we were at about 2.3%. So we are seeing that. And also, of course, we're seeing some of those 60-plus account aging or aged accounts with larger balances. We're also seeing substantially more requests for installment payments, which we're accommodating very well. I think it's very important to work with the customers, and our customer service group has been doing a great job. And so we will have full report on those metrics. I also want to report we reopened the main lobby. As you know, we announced that to the board. You look at that, you don't see a lot of people in the main lobby, but last week we had 210 customers come in for payment transactions in the lobby, 52 customers a day. And so I think customers are using that service, and several of our customers don't have means to pay electronically or otherwise, and so they need to come in and make those direct payments, and we encourage that. So again, we'll give a full update on the customer service metrics at the June 17th board meeting. Under item of interest, we continue to work on our bill, SB 414, the Small System Water Authority. On May 27th, we had a third meeting with CMUA, our co-sponsor, and the State Water Resources Control Board staff and board members regarding the bill. Very good discussion. We continue to narrow down the language, and as the state board members who are participating said, we're down to kind of the short strokes here, so I think they're getting very comfortable with the bill and how it can effectively be used. In that regard, the bill is a two-year bill. It was residing in the Assembly Appropriations Committee. That bill will be brought up most likely in August in the Assembly Appropriations Committee. We're working with the committee consultants and will be working with the committee consultants to put the bill analysis together. And part of that was we had last year, based on the bill, put together a very detailed financial model of how the formation of these water authorities will work. with the changes that we have been working with the state board and others on. It's changed that and actually reduced the costs for the formation of the small system water authorities. So we recently updated the financial model and are finalizing that, and we'll be able to give that to the committee consultant so they can quantify the costs of the formations. Last, I'd just like to point out that we completed our diversions this year from the San Jacinto River. Those have now ceased for the year. But we were able to capture 1,438 acre feet, which is a good rate of capture. Of course, we have the entitlement to capture over 5,000 acre feet, but obviously we rarely see that. But it was a good year, but that recharge from the San Jacinto River has ceased. So with that, are there any questions on my report?
Do you have any questions?
No. Excellent report.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. Laura.
Nothing today.
Nick.
Good morning. Yes, thank you. I have one item I'd like to share. Earlier this week on Monday, the San Diego LAFCO Commission took up the matter of forming an advisory committee with regards to the Fallbrook and Rainbow applications that they've received for those two agencies to detach from the San Diego County Water Authority. There was a lot of discussion with regards to the makeup, membership, and purpose of this advisory committee. At the end of the day, there was an improvement for an advisory committee that consisted of 10 members, including a membership from Fallbrook, Rainbow, the San Diego County Water Authority, Eastern Municipal Water District, and a number of others, including representation from the Special District Advisory Committee of LAFCO and LAFCO's City Advisory Committee. They asked for representation to come from the County of San Diego, as well as SANDAG, the San Diego Association of Governments, and then two other members from the remaining other 22 member agencies from San Diego County Water Authority. So in addition to Fallbrook and Rainbow, there would be representation from two other of those county water authority agencies. So it's a very, very large advisory committee. I'm very pleased that we're part of it. I had reached out to their executive officer and suggested that Eastern should be part of any advisory committee that was formed. Initially, he felt that we would definitely be able to support more of a technical role to address the water system and supply reliability issues, but he didn't think that the purpose of this would necessitate Eastern to be a part of it. But ultimately, there was consensus that we should play a role in that. The chair, Diane Jacobs of LAFCO, who made the motion to form this advisory committee, had expressed that her expectation is that this advisory committee will help bring consensus with regards to an amicable agreement that would then necessitate the applications of Fallbrook and Rainbow to be rescinded, or pending that there would be consensus with regards to what's being described as the exit fee for Fallbrook and Rainbow to move on from the County Water Authority and annex into Eastern. So I think those are very high expectations. The executive director, Keene Simmons, said that he thought that this advisory committee would go into effect and would be active at least through the rest of this calendar year and into early next year before there's anything that's brought back as in the form of a recommendation to the commission. But we're a part of it, and we look forward to seeing where all this goes for Fallbrook and Rainbow. Questions?
Nick, is the advisory committee a Brown Act? Does it fall under the Brown Act?
Yes, it is. That was clarified. It will be a Brown Act committee.
But I think to Nick's point, and an important point, it is not an advisory committee to the commission. It's an advisory committee to staff at LAFCO. So, and that's, I think, an important distinction.
So what is her position with LAFCO? Is she like what Spilotis used to be, or?
Diane Jacobs, she's the chair of LAFCO and is a San Diego County board supervisor.
And she expressed,
I think her term actually expires the end of this calendar year, so it's going to be interesting to see with that changeover you know, where this advisory committee goes, but it's been put in motion based on, you know, her request.
So she expressed, though, that what she wanted to see out of it was that they come to an agreement not to leave San Diego County Water Authority.
She's expressed a hope and expectation that the parties can reach an agreement and understanding that would then not require LAFCO to render a determination on the applications that are submitted. But I don't think the Fallbrook and Rainbow and the County Water Authority have had much success at coming to the table to negotiate this matter to date anyway.
So this advisory committee's got nothing to do then with all the lawsuits being put forth?
The lawsuits?
No.
No. Okay. No, it's strictly an advisory committee, as Paul says, to LAFCO staff in helping them understand the details and circumstances and come to a determination on the applications that Fallbrook and Rainbow have submitted.
You had said at yesterday's meeting something about did Fallbrook and Rainbow agree that San Diego County Water Authority was not a district under that Cortese-Knox?
San Diego County Water Authority, under the LAFCO provisions and the act, submitted an application to be deemed a non-district, and there's a definition of what that is, and there's certain criteria that allows for that. And essentially what that means, as a non-district, then they would not fall under the protest provisions of the
It's only only relative to the protest.
But they haven't, Fallbrook and Rainbow haven't agreed to that, have they?
Yeah, they did not take any exception to that, and LAFCO have determined that San Diego County Water Authority, this was at the prior commission meeting, that they are not, they are a non-district, and that any protest provisions that might be required, and that would occur if ultimately LAFCO determines that Fallbrook and Rainbow can detach, and it's protested, it would go to a public vote, but they would follow the provisions of the San Diego County Water Authority Act with regards to that.
Director Corona, with respect to that finding, it's because the County of Water Authority Act has a unique provision in it that does say if an entity wants to detach, that it would be subject to a public vote within that entity's, Rainbow and Fallbrook's, service area. So I think LAFCO found that the normal protest provisions of Cortese-Knox, where the LAFCO makes a determination that an entity can detach and then it is subject to a public protest, you know, and if they get a certain threshold, it then would go to a vote, that this part of the Water Authority Act basically circumvents that. So it's for that narrow protest provision, they deem them not a special district under Cortese-Knox for that purpose. So it's not in general.
And Mr. Chair, this is Stephen O'Neill. I'd also volunteer that there was a CEQA action that was brought challenging potential action by LAFCO, but I believe that's been dismissed.
Yes, that was one of County Water Authority's member agencies. Otay Water District brought a CEQA challenge, but they've dropped that and it's been dismissed.
Oh, good. Okay. Terrific. All right. Joe.
Good morning. Nothing today.
Jeff.
Good morning. Nothing for me today.
All right. Terrific. With that, we'll go to agenda item 3, which is a consent calendar. I'll accept a motion and a second for approval of items 3A through 3I.
I'll make that motion.
I'll second the consent calendar.
It's been moved and seconded. Roll call, please.
Director Sullivan?
Aye.
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Thank you. And with that, it's approved unanimously. With that, we'll go to agenda item 4, which is the action calendar. 4A is to approve and authorize an award of contract with Paso Robles Tank Incorporated for $494,498.25 under specification number 1395. for the Markham tank interior recoding and the additional appropriation of $749,700. Sean.
Good morning, directors. Good morning. Happy to be here in front of you today. I had my first opportunity to present to the O&E committee last week, and it's wonderful to be here. With some indulgence, our presentation today actually covers item A and B, the two tank recodings.
Okay.
So if we can take those items together, it would be greatly appreciated.
Yes.
All right. First, we're going to start talking, discuss a little bit about the Markman tank. So in general, so the district has a preventive maintenance program for the water storage tanks, which includes diving them every 3 years, creating a condition assessment from that report, and revising our recommendations on which tanks require recoding. So recently, staff reviewed and prioritized those tanks, and the two tanks that floated to the top were the Markham and Citrus tanks. In addition to this, we're also going to need some additional engineering support services from our design engineer, Dudek, through construction. So the first tank is the Markham tank. It's a 500,000 gallon welded steel tank in our 1872 pressure zone. It was constructed in 1963. It is located in the city of Paris. The Citrus II tank is a 7.2 million gallon welded steel tank constructed in 1995 for our 1627 pressure zone. It too is located in the city of Paris. Condition assessment, you can see here from the photos from the recent thing is that we recent inspection is that we have fairly significant corrosion at the center column near the rafters. It is not an uncommon location as the vapor space tends to stay moist in that area. So our recommendations and the overall project schedule you see from the interior photos, we would like to recoat the interior. We've discovered that over time that the interior ladders are a source of corrosion and not very well used for entering the tank, so we would like to remove those. Perimeter vents to help the tank breathe. Some safety improvements with railings around the tank as well as on the roof hatch, and to replace the cathodic protection system to extend their life. If the board approves the two items today, we would start construction this month, wrapping those up in March of 2021. And from at the bottom section there, you can see the two periods that we would be shutting the tanks down in order to maximize availability of water in the system. So the bid results from the Markham tank. We had 11 bidders, six of which were deemed responsive. Our lowest responsible bidder was Paso Robles Tank in the amount of $541,000, about 8.6% below the engineer's estimate. The Citrus II tank, a little bit different story here. Also, Paso Robles was our low bidder at $2.226 million, almost 25% below the engineer's estimate. What that suggested is that maybe there was something not quite right, so I personally called the folks at Paso Robles Tank to chat with them, go over their bid, make sure that everything was in there, that what they saw differently than we did. What they shared with me is that with the demand loss in oil industry, we are seeing oil field coating tank contractors showing up in the market. So we're seeing a much more competitive market for tank recoating. Good for us, so we'll be getting better pricing. Engineering support during construction. Dudek Engineers was our engineer of record during the design to put the packages together. We'd like to continue services with them for pre-construction meetings, shop drawing reviews, some of the structural items, the safety railing that we're going to be adding, as well as creating the as-built markups. The fee for each tank, similar levels of work, is approximately $45,000 each, which brings us to the end of the presentation and our recommendations. Recommendation from staff today is to approve the items as presented. And I'm happy to answer any questions on the two tank coating projects.
Have any questions? Steve?
I have a question, just kind of off the subject a little bit, but do we have tanks where, like in the wintertime, where there's not as much demand and the water sits for a long time and where it potentially needs to be mixed or?
For turnover?
Yes. Do you want to answer that, please?
Yeah, we do, actually. And we actively manage those storage in particular portions of our system by fluctuating the levels. We do have mixers installed in several of our tank systems to help us with that problem, which generally it's a problem known as nitrification. So we actively manage that, and as a result of that, we pretty much keep all of our storage online. We just operate different levels in the winter during low demand periods.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Thank
you. Any other questions?
Director, at present.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Go ahead. Director Record, go ahead.
No, I don't know who that was. I didn't ask for any, I don't have any comments or questions.
Oh, I thought somebody did.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, this is O'Neill speaking. I just wanted to clarify that given the staff report that if it's the board's intention, I just want to clarify that the motion would be 4A and 4B.
Yeah, correct.
That's what I was going to say.
I'll make a motion to approve items 4A and 4B.
I'll second.
It's been moved and seconded. Roll call, please.
Director Sullivan?
Aye.
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Motion approves unanimously. Thank you. Go to 4C, which is approve and authorize an award of contract with Hemet Manufacturing Company for $615,384 under specification 1402P. For the Winchester Recycled Water Transmission Main Cathodic Protection Rehabilitation, and with an additional appropriation of $895,700. John.
Thank you, sir. As indicated, this is an award of contract for the Winchester Recycled Water Transmission Main Cathodic Protection. The overview of the project, it's approximately 3.9 miles of pipeline along Leon Road. It's 24 inches in diameter. It was constructed in the mid-90s. We've experienced multiple leaks, and investigation of the cause of those leaks turns out to be substantial corrosion along the pipeline. So the project scope, it would be to install 38 cathodic test stations, installation of sacrificial anodes, which are intended to dissolve before the pipe, and also to ensure electrically continuity along the entire run of the pipeline. So where we find breaks, where we're not getting the signals that we're testing to move forward, we will have to dig down and investigate and make weld repairs to bring the continuity back to the pipeline. So construction bids, we opened bids on April 7th. Advertised on April 7th, opened on May 6th. We received four bid packages. Our lowest bidder was Hemet Manufacturing, also known as Genesis Construction, in the amount of $615,384. Our engineer's estimate was slightly over $1 million. Again, with a 41% difference, I reached out to Genesis to talk to them pretty extensively about their bid, make sure that, again, they weren't missing anything and we weren't going to set us up for conflict during construction. They assured me that their bid was solid. They've done similar projects in the past for other agencies as well as for the district, and they are 100% comfortable that their number is going to work for them. We do require some engineering support services through construction. HDR, that's our consultant who's been helping with the condition assessment and the corrosion design. Layton Consulting, for any additional geotechnical work when we have to backfill or investigate some other soil parameters if we find any. And then surveying services from Krieger and Stewart in order to effectively locate all of the new cathodic test stations and keep them up to date in our system. So our schedule, board meeting today, if the board awards the contract today, we will issue a notice to proceed immediately. The construction duration is 180 days, so we'd expect this to finish up in the winter. So our recommendations are presented on the side, and staff recommends that we move those as presented. And I'm happy to answer.
Just had a quick question, since it's my area. Is this going to require any traffic control or any traffic issues?
There will be traffic control. They will be point sources. Where we're constructing a cathodic test station and running new wires, we would set up a watch manual style, just minor, not major road closures or anything like that, just in the location.
Okay, and that is something that Hemet Manufacturing then subcontracts out?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, any other questions? If not?
I will move item 4C.
Do we have a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. Roll call, please.
Director Sullivan?
Aye.
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Item C is approved unanimously. It'll go to agenda item 4D, which is approve and authorize an agreement term sheet with Western Municipal Water District for the North Paris Groundwater Program. Joe.
Good morning, President Sullivan, members of the board. Over the last several months, we have been discussing with Western development of an agreement for their participation in our North Paris Groundwater Program. Wanted to give you a quick overview where we stand with the program and then discuss the terms and conditions that we've agreed upon with the Western staff. As the board is aware, our North Paris Groundwater Program consists of multiple wells, north, east, and immediately south of the March Air Reserve Base, up to 9 extraction wells, as well as a number of monitoring wells that will be constructed. There are a number of contaminants in the area. We will need wellhead treatment facilities, including granular activated carbon and ion exchange to the north in the Marina Valley wells, where we expect to produce approximately 2,000 acre feet per year. The Cactus Corridor wells will produce approximately 3,700 acre feet per year, and we will need blending stations as well as granular activated carbon. And we anticipate up to 6 wells within that cluster. And then to the south, we have well 204, which again will require wellhead treatment, and we anticipate about 1,000 acre feet per year production. In aggregate, we anticipate to produce around 6,750 acre feet per year once the program is operational. The program goals are to remediate the contaminants in the area of Marina Valley and North Paris, and not only remediate the volatile organic compounds, nitrates and perchlorates, and there's a mixture of contaminants that we'll be treating, but also contain those contaminants. We do not want the contaminants to migrate further south. That may, if that occurs, that may impact our groundwater production wells, such as Well 55 and the City of Paris production wells. So the program has a dual objective of remediating and containing those contaminants. In addition, the program will develop a local groundwater potable resource, and that will provide a secondary supply to the March Air Reserve Base. And this is one of the reasons why we wanted to engage with Western to negotiate the terms of this agreement. And another benefit, as the board is aware of this program, is to remediate the long-term rising groundwater conditions beneath the March Air Reserve Base. In some areas, the groundwater level is within 3 to 5 feet of surface. There's a risk of liquefaction on base. So the program will have that additional benefit to the March Air Reserve Base. As the board is aware, we've been negotiating with the State Water Resource Control Board for several months to secure a grant. Initially, we were notified of an award of $36 million in grant funding. The last couple of months, we have met with the State Board staff. They've asked for a number of additional items to be added to the program, including additional monitoring wells, refinement of the groundwater modeling, and some other program elements. We've also included our program management cost, land acquisition cost, and of course, market conditions relative to construction costs. We're seeing an escalation in certain type of equipment, such as granular activated carbon, given the GAC or the PFAS contaminant issue in Southern California, where we're seeing an escalation in those costs. Ultimately, we identified an increased program cost up to almost $90 million. We revised and submitted an application to the State Board for 50% of the program cost. I'm pleased to report that last week, General Manager Paul Jones executed the funding agreement in the amount of $44.9 million with the state. It is the largest single grant funding that the district has secured. We're really proud of the achievement. In addition, as the board is aware, we have continued our collaboration with the Air Force. As General Manager Jones recently mentioned to the board, we had a important meeting with General Coburn at the March Air Reserve Base, and we had a breakthrough, essentially, in terms of the number of items that we've been requesting collaboration on. And specifically, the Air Force is indicated that they will provide us with on-base access to conduct field investigations, such as geotechnical investigations. There will be an exchange of technical information, including their groundwater modeling and groundwater data that will help us calibrate and refine our groundwater model. They have agreed to, and they've already started participating in our stakeholder advisory group that oversees the technical development of the program. And most notably, they have directed their legal counsel to start drafting a coordinated operation and mutual release claims agreement with EMWD. That is something that would protect both EMWD and the Air Force in terms of making certain that we are not going to interfere with each other's groundwater programs, be it their on-base contaminant mitigation efforts versus our program that we are advancing here. And of course, we've also suggested, and they've agreed, that they would review and concur with our long-term operational plan for the program, which is a 20-year monitoring plan that will be developed in coordination with the State Water Resource Control Board. So really pleased that we've had this significant advancement in our discussions with the Air Force. In terms of the agreement with Western, the key terms that are attached to the board letter address the participation approach, the overall program, technical development and review, grant funding, advocacy, interface with Marshall Reserve Base, interagency coordination between Western and EMWD, and the proposed agreement has an initial term of 20 years with additional 10-year extension upon mutual agreement between the two agencies. In terms of participation approach, Eastern will design, build, and operate and own all the program facilities. The program facilities will be located wholly within EMWD's service area. Western shall have the option to purchase program water from Eastern to serve the demands within March Air Reserve Base. Currently, that demand is approximately 500 acre feet per year. There is an allocation schedule that is specified in the term sheets within the initial 5 years that may increase if demands are realized up to 750 acre feet per year, and ultimately capping out at 1,500 acre feet per year at year 11. So that would be the maximum amount of water that would be provided to Western under this agreement. And the unit cost of the water will be based upon the amortized capital of the program, obviously accounting for the grant funding that we have secured, as well as the capital, operational, and maintenance cost to deliver that water to Western. Currently, the estimate for the cost of water for this program is approximately $700 per acre foot, significantly below the imported water rates. Western will be involved in a number of our advisory groups and committees, the stakeholder advisory group that will oversee the overall program technical development. In fact, we had a kickoff March 11th. Whereby Western attended, as well as the Air Force, the Regional Board, and the State Board. Western is also involved in our Technical Advisory Committee, as well as the Groundwater Model Advisory Panel. And again, we will be calibrating that model based on the data provided by the Air Force. I should mention that one of the key terms in the term sheet is that Western will commit to not constructing any groundwater wells within the proximity of this program that may interfere with our operations of the program without initially submitting it for review by Eastern and having our approval before they can advance such a well. In terms of grant funding and program advocacy, again, as you're aware, we executed the funding agreement with the State Water Resource Control Board. Those funds will offset the capital cost component for the cost of water under this program, and that will obviously be reflected in the cost of water provided to Western Municipal Water District. All state and federal advocacy for the program shall be coordinated with Eastern Municipal Water District, and all external communication for the program shall also be coordinated with Eastern. If Eastern or Western were to secure additional grant funding for the program, then obviously that would reduce the reconciled amortized capital costs for the program. In terms of interface with March Air Reserve Base, March is a customer of Western Municipal Water District. Thus, all aspects of water and sewer service will be reserved for Western Municipal Water District. We recognize there will be a number of program meetings whereby MARB staff will be involved. Those meetings will be jointly coordinated by Eastern and Western. We will obviously continue to have our regular ad hoc committee meetings with Western, and at those meetings, we will be providing regular periodic updates on the program advancement. Once the program is operational, we will be meeting on an annual basis if not more frequently, with Western staff to reconcile their demands at MARB to allocate that water supply for the following year, to reconcile the operational cost and reconcile the overall cost of water associated with the program. So our recommendation is to authorize the general manager to execute an agreement with Western based on the terms and conditions that have been provided to you. With that, I know General Manager Paul Jones and I have been extensively involved in the discussions with Western. We both would be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
You might want to note that this was taken up at Western's engineering
yes.
committee, and they approved the item with a recommendation for approval for their full board. So there's substantial support on Western's side for this, and we think it's a very, very good arrangement for both parties.
Yeah, thank you, Paul. And in fact, the item is being moved to the full Western board on June 17th for consideration.
President Slauson, let's direct the record. First of all, I'd like to move the item, but secondly, I'd just like to comment that this is a really great program, and Eastern staff has just done a phenomenal job, not only getting the grants, but dealing with Western and sometimes a kind of difficult situations, especially Paul coming up with creative ideas on how to work with them and kind of bring them in. And I really want to compliment Paul and staff on this program. It's just, I think it speaks loudly about the district's ability to do really great things.
Thank you, Director Rickard.
Yeah, I would second that. I just believe it's been an interesting journey to get to this point. It is also the ability of Western to sit down and work through this. Both Tim Barr and Craig Miller should be applauded for their interest in this. And also at the time it was Director Stockton, who is no longer with us. But I think everyone reached an agreement to move forward, and this term sheet goes a real long way, along with the grants that we're able to get. And I agree with Director Rickard's comments that our staff does exceptional things to move things forward in a progressive way. Thank you.
I will just concur all those comments too, and nice work on everyone's behalf on this.
Thank you.
Okay. We'll entertain a motion in a second.
I already moved it.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Have a second?
I'll second it.
It's been moved and seconded. Roll call, please.
Director Sullivan?
Aye.
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Rickard?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Thank you. With that, we'll go to 4E, which is approve and authorize an award of contracts for the integration services with Bevens Systems for $432,236 and procurement of hardware with Royal Industry Solutions for $668,106 for the Paris Valley Regional Water Reclamation Facility Programmable Logic Controllers Upgrade and funding for the total project cost in the amount of $1,360,000. Matt.
Good morning. My items always seem to be a mouthful, it seems like. this is the third one of these projects, so I'll try to keep this brief. You guys have seen this a couple times already. We've completed this at San Jacinto and at Moreno Valley, and this is to move forward with the upgrade of our control systems at Paris. So I'll just do a brief explanation of why we're doing it, the work we're going to get done, the bids we received, project cost and schedule. So this is the control system for the plant that runs the facility 24 hours per day. It allows us to remotely monitor and access the facility for on-call response during dark times. And the system is also constantly collecting and storing historical data for regulatory reporting purposes and to do evaluations on how the process is performing. And so the hardware involved are the programmable logic controllers, or the PLCs. There's some input and output devices that connect that computer to the field devices where all the wiring terminates. and then some network switches and equipment and some of the field devices. So the existing system we have installed now is called PLC-5. It came into service in the 80s, and as of 2017, the manufacturer officially stopped supporting this equipment. So we can no longer get support from them or buy parts, and there's no longer any software updates. So as we are accessing the system remotely, the plant is exposed to the internet, and we need to keep all of these things up to date for security reasons. So what we're gonna move forward with is Control Logics. They've updated the names to programmable automation controllers instead of PLCs. And so all those other supporting equipment and hardware we talked about. So since the system will be supported for a long time, it'll increase our reliability of the system, security, and also the physical safety of the staff that run the systems, as we'll see in some pictures coming up. So while we do this, we're gonna rebuild the cabinets where all the hardware sits and reorganize them, and then we'll get some good set of as-built drawings at the completion of the project, and we'll have good records of what's there. So on the left is the old hardware. It's been in service for over 30 years, and as I mentioned, it's no longer supported as of 2017. The right-hand side is the new controllers. Those are state-of-the-art today, and we've been assured that Allen Bradley and Rockwell are going to support these for likely for another 30-year period, so we're expecting a good long life out of this investment. So this is a picture from when we did the San Jacinto project. That's what the cabinets look like before. You can see they're a little disorganized from the many years of add-ons and changes with the way the wiring's there. The lower arrows pointing to that termination hardware, where you can hopefully on your monitor you can see it's just a bunch of screws that aren't covered by anything. And this is what that same cabinet looked like when the project was over. So you can see the new control hardware on the top. All those terminations were done in updated hardware that are finger safe, so when staff go in there to troubleshoot, they're not exposed to any voltages or anything. Much neater and cleaner, and you can see the little pocket on the left there with the as-built drawings that were turned in. So we put out an RFP for the integration services. We received three proposals from the same three companies that we tend to receive proposals from. This time around, Bevins was the lowest bidder and also highest rated proposal. They also did the San Jacinto project, and things went well. And Bevins has done a lot of work for us in our treatment plants over the years, which is part of what makes them so competitive. The hardware, we went directly to Royal Industrial for the hardware. That's the only place we're able to buy it from. So we negotiated with them directly and avoided the overhead and profit markups from the contractor. So this is the project cost estimate with the bid from Bevins, the quote from Royal Industrial Solutions. We're gonna do some fiber optic installations to improve the network of the control system. Our estimate of staff labor and a 15% contingency comes out to $1,360,000. We did have a $1.5 million budget for this in OFA. So our schedule is, assuming approval of the contract today, we'll get things executed. In July, we expect to begin working and then finish the project in June of 21. And so the recommendation is to award to Bevins for about $432,000, Worrell Industrial for the hardware for $668,000, and then the total appropriation for $1,360,000.
I would like to add, you guys that have been on the board for a long period of time have realized kind of a change in the way we're doing this type of work. We've been competing these services for these types of projects in the past 8 or so years. Originally, a lot of this work was farmed out to predominantly one company within the wastewater plants. And now we've brought in two other firms that kind of give us a deeper bench. Each firms have their different strengths, but we've been largely satisfied with the work by all three firms. little rocky startup initially with a couple of the firms, but they've come along and kind of learned our standards and how to execute these projects in conjunction with our staff. And so I've been very pleased with how we've been able to move from a kind of a one-source model to a competitive model. It's worked out really well for us.
Yeah, terrific. Okay, any questions?
Staff's recommendation.
I'll second it.
It's been moved and seconded. All in favor? Or, I'm sorry, roll call.
Director Sullivan?
Aye.
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Motion carries unanimously. We'll go to agenda item 5, which is the information item, and it's a COVID-19 surveillance and wastewater. Matt?
Yeah, so we thought we'd bring this to folks today just to kind of give some information on COVID-19 and the potential risks as it relates to staff and the public, and then to also talk a little bit about a lot of the efforts going on with regards to surveillance of wastewater for helping to manage the pandemic. It's been pretty, there's been a pretty active area of research lately, and even since I've written this presentation, there's been some more things that have been going on, so I'll try to cover all those as we go through. So we'll talk a little bit about how we detect COVID-19 in the wastewater, what the surveillance really is, and then go into some of the safety things, like how it's deactivated and what the risks are, the things that the industry has figured out so far, and then some of the things that we're continuing to work on. So everything that I've written down in this presentation, I actually got from some very informative webcasts that have been put on in conjunction by CWA in conjunction with CASA. They had several speakers here, Amy Kirby, Charles Gerba, and Dr. Rasha from WEF. They provide a lot of great insight on what's happening. Since then, I've seen more from the Water Research Foundation. CASA has taken some other steps, so we'll get to all those things. So I thought it would be helpful to introduce how we do the testing. They use some method called polymerase chain reaction, and really all that's doing is looking for portions of the genome of the virus. So that diagram down there is sort of a depiction of the virus, and there's certain proteins in there that are picked up. So all that does is tell you it's there. It tells you nothing about whether or not it's infectious or dangerous to you. It's just present. If you want to figure out if it's infectious, you actually have to take that material and try to culture it and see if it will grow. That's the only way to know if it's viable. So that kind of puts into perspective a lot of the testing and results when people say that it's found. Usually it's by this test, and it just means it's there. It doesn't mean it's dangerous. So surveillance of wastewater has been used in the past for many things to assess pathogens in the wastewater. It was used pretty widely to look at polio. Other places have used a similar type of work to see if their system maybe has failed in certain places and leaking into surface waters. Hampton Roads actually has been doing this for years, and they did find some capital projects they needed to do by using these methods. So there's a number of things that you could use the surveillance for. With relates to COVID-19, the thought is to use this information to try and estimate the level of infection in the community. So you can get a good early indication of spikes in infections. You could see if things are staying level or perhaps levels of infections are falling. To date, that's really all we can do with it is see these trends and see if it's there or not. Another thing that makes it useful is it's not really influenced by human or economic considerations. So you know, whether or not people have health insurance and will even go to the doctor and get a test, this catches all those people, including people who are asymptomatic. One of the challenges is that while the PCR test is pretty widely used, there's really no accepted methodology for collecting the sample, preparing the sample, and then running the test. So people have started to do this work all over the country, but they're all doing it in a different way. So There's really not a good reliable way to compare results from state to state or even, you know, service area to service area, depending on the organization that's doing the work. Some people, I think this is an illustration of that fact, is some folks report that they can detect 2 to 3 cases per 100,000 people. Other folks have said it takes 1 in 10,000 or 2 to 300 per 100,000. So there's kind of a wide variability in terms of sensitivity of the test. As I mentioned, we have seen so far that these methods can show trends, and we have seen it in looking at data before stay-at-home orders were issued. Then while stay-at-home orders were in place, you could see things level off, and some people even saw infection levels fall. So it's proven itself in that regard. So again, thoughts of using this data is to assess maybe how effective these mitigation measures are, figure out where the greatest need for resources could be, and get early warnings on things as they develop. Some other thoughts are, you know, we read in the media that certain communities are being hit harder by the virus than others. So in Oregon, for instance, they're going to use some other GIS layers that very accurately pinpoint socioeconomic conditions, you know, income, perhaps ethnicity, where hospitals, prisons are, and they're overlaying that with their sewer system GIS layers, and they're pinpointing places that they're going to go and sample just to study how the disease is impacting different communities. So one thing to consider, though, is that all of these tests are competing for the same supply chain that is being used on people. The big advantage is that one test covers a wide area and population, so it can actually save some resources. So in terms of deactivating COVID-19, it's actually thought that it's very susceptible to environmental conditions, which means it should be very easy to deactivate it and render it safe using standard disinfection measures, including UV. And so from healthcare, this diagram here shows the relative ease of disinfecting, and enveloped viruses, which COVID-19 is all the way at the bottom, meaning it's most susceptible to disinfection. Treatment plants, our wastewater treatment plants, are actually designed around the assumptions that we're deactivating non-enveloped viruses, which are several steps up the ladder. Our processes, everything that we do today, are designed around pathogens that are more difficult to handle. There are several treatment barriers in place in the treatment plant, such as the primary, secondary, and tertiary treatment processes. So work done at the University of Arizona has found that after the secondary treatment process, they can no longer detect any of the genetic material of the virus. So even though it's going into the plant by secondary, we're already at non-detect levels. So the treatment plants are very effective at handling COVID-19. So due to these things, it's thought that COVID-19 and wastewater is no more dangerous than any of the other, you know, pathogens that are in the wastewater every single day. It is a risk, but it's not thought to be, at this time, a greater risk than anything else. So all these current controls, typical PPE that we would wear, are considered at this time enough to keep our staff safe. And due to the effectiveness of the treatment process, the public is also thought to be safe from COVID-19. So future efforts, what's not very well understood is whether or not bioaerosols are going to carry the virus and be infectious. So we haven't figured out yet if the virus that's in the raw wastewater is infectious. And if it turns out to be, can this stuff be put into an aerosol and perhaps put people at risk? So there's a study going on to see if, you know, the spray that comes out of the manhole when you're cleaning, or perhaps water flowing over a weir in a treatment plant, is enough to make it airborne and pose a risk. There's also work beginning to culture these samples, so we'll see if they'll grow from these samples in wastewater and try and get an idea what that tells us. when it comes to the overall surveillance of the virus in the wastewater, as I mentioned, all we can do is see these trends and get a relative idea for what's happening. So there's a lot of people trying to set up epidemiological studies to see if we can figure out by the result you get in wastewater what that means for the number of sick people in the community, so you could start tying a number to that. There is also absent this data about whether or not it's infectious in the water. There's some studies going on to look at the infection rate of wastewater workers versus the general population. So, if we find out that wastewater workers are getting infected at the same rate as general population, then you could assume that the water is actually not really posing any direct risk to the staff or to the public. EB Mud, I had a bullet here, is engaged in multiple studies. However, LA County, Orange County, the entire state of Oregon has kicked off. I talked about Hampton Roads, Southern Nevada. They're all doing a lot of work in this area, trying to learn everything they can and push this research forward. There's the Water Research Foundation recently has asked for proposals of qualifications. They're working on trying to standardize the test methods. I just saw the letter this morning that CASA wrote to the CDC urging them to take a leadership role at the federal level to standardize test methods, provide funding, and sort of coordinate overall effort countrywide to get this going and try to put this information to use. Water Research Foundation also briefed Congress on all of these things, and they were urging Congress also to take a role and provide funding and resources. And finally, the Water Research Foundation is currently working with the Water Board to put together the regulations for direct potable reuse. And in that, they were looking at various pathogens as part of the whole process, and they decided to add COVID-19 specifically to their study through that whole cycle. So that's also beginning to be looked at. And in general, other organizations I've seen have made the same conclusion that if this is really going to be useful, it can't just be water agencies working on it. It needs to be a partnership with state and federal health officials to work together on getting this information and actually putting it to use to manage the pandemic. And it seems in Oregon they're actually doing that. The Department of Health in Oregon is starting a statewide effort with all of their treatment plants statewide to start looking at these things. And that's all I had.
You have any questions of Matt?
Excellent report. Thank you.
Yes.
You're welcome.
Thank you. All right, let's take a 10-minute break before we get into the rest of the remaining part of